Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 15th of March, these are our main stories. As we record this podcast, more than 220 people are known to have died in floods and mudslides caused by Tropical Storm Freddy in Malawi. A senior Pakistani official says the security forces in Lahore have suspended efforts to arrest the opposition leader, Imran Khan, because they're disrupting a prestigious cricket tournament. Also in this podcast, 45 days in solitary confinement for a 13-year-old indigenous boy in Australia. And
a wolf proof fence doesn't exist. The wolf is so smart, he overwins every fence.
Some animals just have a right to exist, not just because we find them useful.
Celebrations and controversy over the success of the reintroduction of wolves to the wild in Europe. In our earlier podcast, we heard some of the harrowing tales of the impact Tropical Storm Freddy has had on the people of Malawi. As we record this podcast, the government says more than 220 people are known to have died and thousands more have been displaced. I got the latest from our correspondent, Shingai Nyoka.
Well, some good news. After just some harrowing days, the skies have begun to clear over the commercial capital of Blantyre, and that allows for the airlift operations to start. They will need to conduct search and rescue operations, but they'll also be trying to bring relief in terms of supplies to the areas that have been cut off by road.
And we already know a lot of people have died, many, many, many more displaced. But of those who have survived, obviously things like waterborne diseases are going to become an increasing risk.
And that is the main cause of concern among the UN agencies, for example, who say that Malawi had already been battling its deadliest cholera outbreak in years. There was a concern that because of the water and just not just the floods, but also just access to clean water, that this might actually exacerbate the situation.
This is widely being seen as a demonstrable effect of climate change, isn't it?
Yes, and one of the effects that people were talking about is the fact that you have what, according to the record books, is one of the longest lasting cyclones. For the last month or so, Cyclone Freddy has moved from Australia all the way to Malawi and is now heading back to Mozambique. But that really has been the concern, that Southern Africa in particular has borne the brunt of this climate change, that we're seeing more frequent rains, we're seeing more frequent storms, and that they're getting more and more severe. And these are the countries that are least able to cope with the impact of these changes.
What can countries like Malawi do to improve their responses for next time, if next time is going to be more regular?
In Malawi, we're hearing that the warnings were given out ahead of time to some of the communities in low-lying areas and those that live beneath the mountains, but that many people didn't listen to those warnings and only tried to escape when it was too late. The people that are really affected by these cyclones are the poor people who generally don't have access to quality buildings. And so these are some of the areas that governments think that they can improve on.
Shingai Nyoka. Well, Mozambique has also been hit by Freddy, but whereas 4 years ago the death toll there from a similar storm was nearly 500, this time it's been 51. Evidence, says the country's humanitarian coordinator, Myrta Coulard, that Mozambique's special programme of investments is working.
The country has invested in quite sophisticated early warning systems. So there are satellite imageries and it's able to anticipate when a natural disaster is about to hit. So there is time and there is communication and populations are aware. Shelters are created and buildings are also built in a different way. So they are more resilient and resist better to heavy winds and rains. Now, of course, this is a very long long-term process, and this is a very costly process. So results are partial yet, but we start to see the results of these investments because 51 people have lost their lives compared to nearly 500 people 4 years ago.
Murta Coulard in Mozambique. Cricket is a way of life in Pakistan, and if Punjab's information minister is to be believed, this has put a stop to the operation to arrest the former Prime Minister Imran Khan at his home in Lahore. Amir Mir has told the BBC that this has now been suspended until after the 19th of March, the final of Pakistan's Super League cricket tournament. Yesterday and today, the security forces surrounded Mr. Khan's home using tear gas and water cannon against supporters of his PTI party. Today, he spoke to them from inside his house.
They fired bullets at us. Those who fired the bullets were not here to put me in front of a court. They have also tried to kill me before. Their aim was not to put me before a court. More than that, they want to exclude me from politics. That's the reason they came to arrest me.
A local official has denied that live rounds were fired. The security forces wanted to arrest Mr. Khan for not turning up at court to defend charges that he unlawfully sold state gifts. He says the case is politically motivated. We got more on Imran Khan's position from the barrister Hassan Niazi, a legal representative and advisor to Mr. Khan.
A few months ago, when he was attacked in one of the rallies, when he was shot four times, he nearly escaped a murder attempt. And the people, the supporters, they don't trust the law enforcement agencies anymore, especially the police. Hence, our only concern was that this summon of the court for arrest of Chairman Imran Khan could result in another attempt to murder. And that could leave us as a leaderless societies.
Okay. You've said that he's willing to appear before the court. So why doesn't he comply with the court order and go with the police officers who have been sent by the court to take him to court?
There have been 77 cases, and in every case, Mr. Khan has appeared in the court, has surrendered himself for the investigation and to the court. The reason he is avoiding it is because our petition is in the higher court regarding the security. This very court is the same court where in a few years ago there was a terrorist attack and a judge was killed and a lot of lawyers were killed, and we have a fear. It's a complete security risk. The whole place is so congested with a lot of high rise. So all we are asking is that either move the court to some other courts which are located in the higher court, maybe, or the special courts, which are like 2 kilometres away from that
right.
court.
So, I mean, ordinary Pakistanis don't get to choose which court they're tried in, do they? Why should he get special treatment? We have seen photos of several people who are clearly struggling to cope with the effects of tear gas, and some of them appear to have blood on them. These are supporters of his party. Isn't the responsible thing for him to say, look, this is getting out of hand, you should go home to keep yourselves safe, there will be no more clashes, I don't want to see this outside my home?
Absolutely. That's the best route.
But he's saying people should come on the streets. He isn't saying people should go away from
that
site.
Because he's fighting for these very people. He's not fighting for himself. Today, a lot of supporters were shot with live ammunition, and the bullets of SMG and 9mm were found, the shells were found, and we've given them to the media, and I've even posted a video myself of making video of the police officer shooting the live bullets at us. So what do you think the police is coming to do? To arrest him or to kill him? Who decides this? Why should we believe what police is saying?
Hassan Niazi talking to Rob Young. I spoke to our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etebrajan. Is cricket really the reason that the authorities are pulling back on arresting Imran Khan?
Ostensibly, because the government wants a way out of this crisis, because for the past 24 hours, security forces, including the paramilitary rangers, they unsuccessfully tried to arrest Imran Khan, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, because of a court order. The court order was issued, the warrant was issued, because he didn't turn up for court hearings to face charges that he incorrectly declared about the state gifts he received from foreign dignitaries while in office. So now the government has come out with a reason saying that because of this cricket tournament, we are now postponing this operation. Imagine, you know, hundreds of police officers, they have been brought from, you know, Islamabad, from different parts of Punjab province for this operation. So they all had to go back. And now the government says that they will stop the operation until the 19th of March, when the final is played of the Pakistan Super League. And in the meantime, the Lahore High Court has ordered the government not to proceed with any operation at least until tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. Pakistan local time. Probably the government was aware of Imran Khan supporters going to the court, so they preempted by announcing the postponement of operation because of cricket.
Imran Khan, of course, insists all this is politically motivated. Who can we believe?
Well, Imran Khan remains hugely popular in Pakistan, and his party won a series of by-elections in the past few months, putting a lot of pressure on the governing coalition. And he says that dozens of cases have been filed against him since he lost power. He was ousted from power in a no-confidence vote in parliament in April last year. So he was arguing that he was unfairly treated and he was unfairly ejected from power, and that's why he had been organizing these huge rallies all across Pakistan, you know, for several months now, putting pressure on the government. And now he argues that many of these cases were fabricated, politically motivated, even though, you know, the courts are still going ahead with the cases. He seems to be having this popularity, and people, his supporters at least, believe in what he says.
Can he come back from all of this?
At the moment, Imran Khan seems to be a bit isolated because he has cut off his links, burnt bridges with the military, powerful military, and also his very antagonistic relationship with the governing coalition. But what he believes is the people's support, and that is what can bring him back to power if the elections are held and also if he's allowed to contest.
Anbar Hassan Etarajan. Across large parts of Europe, the number of wolves is increasing. These animals, once widely hunted, are returning to lands they haven't lived in for more than a century. Two packs have settled in Belgium. But these predators don't always get a warm welcome, as our correspondent Jessica Parker reports from Limburg in the east of the country.
That sound you can hear is a wolf sniffing a camera on a stretch of heathland, planted to track Belgium's emerging wolf population.
So have you ever seen a wolf here?
Yeah, quite often actually.
In the province of Limburg, I go out to try and find signs of the wolf with Jan Huy from the Research Institute for Nature and Forest. He knows what to look for.
So this is wolf feces?
This is wolf feces, yeah. What remains after the rain is just some hairs of the prey.
Why are their numbers growing in Europe, and why are they back in Belgium for the first time in over 100 years?
Yeah. The reason why they're back is mainly legal protection. Because in Europe it started with the Berne Convention in 1970, and later on in 92 there was the Habitats Directive, which obliged all member states to consider the wolf as a protected species. From the early 90s, really a lot has happened in Europe, and the wolves really started to disperse all over the continent.
What does the wolf eat? Deer? Wild boar, but livestock also makes up around 15% of its diet here, according to analysis. Local farmer Johan Scheuterden tells me he's lost dozens of sheep and current compensation doesn't cover the true cost.
We're in a huge barn here. Johan, how many sheep do you actually have in here at the moment?
For the moment, I think 800.
Out in the fields where Johan's sheep graze, he shows me the fencing he's built.
We have guardian dogs to protect our sheep against the wolf, but still we have some attacks.
Some people might say you just need to build a better fence.
Yes, what have you to do no more? We can use more wires, more sticks, but I don't think that there is a wolf-proof fence doesn't exist.
The wolf is so smart, he overwins every fence.
Come.
Johan calls his sheep. Farmers' distress has led EU lawmakers to call for a downgrade in the wolf's protected status. A controversial cull was recently carried out in Sweden.
Well, here we have another wolf print.
Back out on the trail with researcher Jan, he says people must again learn to live alongside the wolf.
Why is it positive that they're back?
Well, first of all, of course, you need to maybe also ask if everything has to have a positive effect on the way we see it as humans. Some animals also just have a right to exist, not just because we find them useful.
In some marshland, a camera picks up a wolf having a drink and then a bathe. Local legend says that the last wolf here was shot by Belgium's king in the 1890s. Now they're back, and while evasive, in this densely populated region, their presence is getting noticed.
That report from Jessica Parker. Still to come.
The unprocessed coca leaf isn't illegal in Bolivia. When it's processed, it's the raw material of cocaine. That is when that shifts into being a drug, a narcotic.
Bolivia and Colombia urged the UN to remove the coca leaf from its list of banned drugs. The United States has said it will continue surveillance flights near the war zone in Ukraine despite the loss of a drone that crashed into the Black Sea after being intercepted by Russian fighter jets. Moscow has denied that Russian jets forced it down after colliding with its propeller. Exactly what type of flying robot then was this drone? David Hambling is the author of the book Swarm Troopers: How Small Drones Will Conquer the World.
This is an MQ-9 Reaper, which is the mainstay of the American drone reconnaissance force. While they can be armed, this one would almost certainly have been carrying out an intelligence gathering mission outside the borders of Ukrainian airspace, keeping an eye on what was happening inside Ukraine, probably using radar or electronic sensors.
How easy would it have been to take it down? I mean, is this likely to have been an accident or something done deliberately?
They didn't deliberately bring it down, but they were deliberately harassing it. It's a very unequal contest with a manned aircraft against a drone like this, because the drone pilot has no situational awareness. They can't see what's happening around them. One pilot is compared the view you get to seeing through a drinking straw, and their cruising speed is something like 200 miles an hour. So the Russian jets could literally fly circles around it. Clearly, they are trying to harass. They're trying to interfere with its ability to carry out its mission by flying close to it and forcing the pilot to make evasive manoeuvres. My suspicion is that in doing so, they simply flew a bit too close and actually clipped it, causing damage that caused the drone to be lost.
It's a costly loss, so something like $20 million, is that right?
Somewhere upwards of $20 million, depending on what additional equipment they have on it. That's not the most expensive drone the Americans have lost. A few years ago, the Iranians shot down a Global Hawk drone, which should have been somewhere over $200 million. Also, these drones operate in what are known as orbits. As soon as one drone goes off station, another one takes its place, so they have 24/7 surveillance. So there will be another drone in exactly the same place as that one, continuing its mission.
Has it happened because Russia just wants to annoy the US, or do you think that they are concerned about the amount, the quality of intelligence that the Americans are getting through these drones?
The Americans are getting a vast amount of intelligence, and that is being fed straight back to Ukraine. According to some reports, every single time the Ukrainians use the HIMARS missile system, the targets for that are located and confirmed using intelligence supplied by the US. So this is probably carrying quite militarily important information.
Do the Russians use similar technology?
The Russians have much less emphasis on their drone fleet, partly for historical reasons. They do have a similar drone called Orion, though it's hardly been seen in this conflict. They don't really have the same type of capabilities on the same scale. And at any rate, obviously, they operate within Ukrainian and Russian airspace, so they don't have to do their reconnaissance from a distance.
David Hambling speaking to James Copnell. To Australia now, and the story of a 13-year-old Indigenous boy who was held in solitary confinement for 45 days while awaiting trial for minor offences. The teenager's treatment at the Cleveland Youth Detention Centre in Townsville is the latest case to raise human rights concerns about the youth justice system in the state of Queensland. Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, told us more.
He's been referred to as Jack. He was released on probation last week after more than 2 months in custody, being held on remand on charges relating to a fight with another boy. His lawyer said that this boy, Jack, had no serious criminal history, describing his incarceration as extraordinary and cruel. And his mother said that he went in to prison as a bright, talkative teenager and came out very withdrawn and very stressed.
Presumably this is a very unusual kind of thing, is it?
We'd like to think so, but according to campaigners in Queensland, it has happened before. In February of this year, it emerged that another 13-year-old boy in the state of Queensland with learning difficulties this time spent 78 days in a cell for 20 hours a day. This is clearly raising concerns over Queensland's youth justice system. And the authorities in Queensland say that solitary confinement is only used as a last resort. And lawyers say that perhaps solitary confinement is being used because of a lack of staff in these facilities. But quite clearly, it is shining a light on the way that young people, children, are treated in that part of the country.
And the law around children being locked up is being looked at as we speak. But I'm told things could get worse for them.
Well, the Queensland government is considering new legislation that could well criminalise bail breaches by children, that is, minors breaching the rules of their release after being accused of crimes. Now, campaigners believe this could cause the youth prison population to rise even higher than it is at the moment. If you look at the statistic, First Nations Australians are up to 12 times more likely to be in jail than non-Indigenous people in the state of Queensland. Rates of juvenile incarceration are also very high. It's estimated that 70% of child inmates in Queensland are Indigenous. And unfortunately, these recent cases of two 13-year-old boys held for such a long time on their own is raising serious concerns again.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. Leonardo da Vinci is arguably the most famous artist of all time, but little is known about his personal life. New research suggests da Vinci was only half Italian because his mother was a slave from the Caucasus. Anna Aslam reports.
It was long thought that Leonardo da Vinci's mother was a Tuscan peasant, but an expert who studied the artist for over a decade, Carlo Vecce, said the truth is more complicated. Using archaeological research and extensive documentation, he claims da Vinci's mother, Caterina, was a princess in the northern Caucasus Mountains, but was kidnapped and sold into slavery, making her way across the Black Sea to Constantinople and Venice before arriving in Florence. There, she worked as a nurse for a wealthy family and had a child out of wedlock with the notary Piero da Vinci. An archive document written in Piero's handwriting declares Caterina's liberation from slavery in November 1452, 6 months after Leonardo's birth. Caterina's mysterious past has been the topic of debate among researchers for decades, and some other experts have agreed with Carlo Vecce's account. Mr. Vecce says Caterina's difficult life had a profound impact on Leonardo da Vinci. He points to overarching themes of freedom in his work and says da Vinci's universal appeal could come from the artist not belonging to a single class, culture or country.
Anna Aslam. Coca leaf is part of everyday life in Bolivia, but the country is banned from exporting it because it's used as the raw material to make cocaine. For indigenous people in the Andes, it's a traditional medicine. Bolivia, together with Colombia, wants the ban lifted. They're urging the United Nations to remove the coca leaf from its list of prohibited narcotics. Its status will now be reviewed by a committee of international experts. For more, I spoke to our reporter, Mimi Swaby.
Coca
coca leaf is actually a plant, and it's been used by indigenous communities across Bolivia and Colombia in the Andean regions as traditional medicine, as well as for social interactions and involved in religious ceremonies. It's widely grown in usually medium altitude parts of the Andes since probably about the Incas or even before, primarily in Las Yungas in the north and to the east of the capital, La Paz. And when it's dried, when the leaves are dried, you can make tea with it, you can chew it, you can grind into powder. There's lots of different forms you can do. Usually you'll see people walking down the street in Bolivia with a wad of chewed up coca leaves in the pouch of their cheek. And that really isn't uncommon. I remember the first time I arrived there, the first thing I was offered was a plastic sack full of leaves and a coca leaf tea to ease the altitude sickness. You've got to remember La Paz, the capital, is extremely high up. It's the highest city in the world. It's 3,650 metres above sea level. So altitude really does hit you, and you can feel nausea, you can have a headache. And that is one of the benefits of coca. It's used, like I said, as medicine, but really to help alleviate altitude sickness.
And it's not illegal, but it is a drug and it does have effects on you.
So that's the differentiation. It's the unprocessed coca leaf isn't illegal in Bolivia. When it's processed, it's the raw material of cocaine. That is when that shifts into being a drug, a narcotic, and that is illegal. So another reason people chew coca is to give them energy. So people who are doing laborious work tend to always have a pouch of coca in their cheek, and that is thought to keep them running through the day.
So why is it important to Bolivia and Colombia to get this ban lifted? And how did it come to be banned in the first place?
It's always been banned since it is recognised as a narcotic internationally. But that is the argument the vice president is putting forward. He's saying, actually, this is a cultural heritage. We need to decolonise this sacred leaf and correct this criminalisation of a really historic part, a cultural part of Bolivian and Colombian society, which is so normalised. People don't see it as a harmful thing. They see it as so integral to society and daily life, really. And this is one of the arguments that the vice president is also putting forward, that actually it needs to be decriminalized so they can export it and show the benefits of coca leaf, and rather than the international community seeing it as the main ingredient for a drug.
Mimi Swaby. Music has been banned in Afghanistan since the Taliban took power in August 2021, but the country's national orchestra is desperately trying to keep Afghan melodies alive. An exiled group of musicians is going on a European tour. Our reporter Shakiba Habib met them at their first concert in Paris.
Shabana is a sitar player, standing tall using an app on a smartphone to tune her stringed instrument. But the sounds from the strings bring back some sad memories.
Music plays a very important role in my life. When I play, I think about the feelings of people. I think about men and women that the Taliban banned from playing music.
Shabana and her friends are some of the youngest musicians of Afghanistan. 13-year-old Sabria plays piano and harmonium.
When the Taliban came, I was sad because I wasn't able to continue studying.
Most of the students say they couldn't believe they would lose everything they had overnight. Imad is 15 and plays tabla.
For now, music has been silenced in Afghanistan. They broke the thing I loved the most.
Back in Afghanistan, they had freedom to perform in public. They had status as professionals. But when the Taliban returned, everything regressed. After breaking all the instruments, the Taliban locked the doors to their music school. The school students are far from defeated.
Back home, they performed in colourful dresses, but today they are in plain dark clothes. Most of them couldn't bring their belongings as they were forced to flee Afghanistan.
The students are now settled in Portugal as refugees, where they revived their music school. Masuda is 15.
We won't let their actions go unnoticed. We will play our music even louder.
Tonight is their first concert of the tour, and it's a sellout show. I spoke to Hadia as she picked up her son Tour to to go to the stage.
How do you feel before going to the stage?
Excited.
Yeah? Which piece do you like the most? The one that's about Afghanistan.
Yes. That's good.
A packed theatre hall greets them. Their selection of melodies brought tears to some members of the audience. And they end their performance with the patriotic masterpiece of Sarzaminiman, or My Homeland, Emad and Sabria.
The Taliban want young girls and boys to be just like them, uneducated, without progress, and without a future.
When the Taliban are gone, I'll go to Afghanistan to teach music to girls and boys.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban have shown no intention of lifting the ban on music. But for now, these students have the world stage, an audience, to hear their message.
Shakiba Habib. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop, and the producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.